Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, David Callahan, is founder of Inside Philanthropy. It's a website that covers the world of giving by wealthy donors and foundations. And over the past few decades, he has seen major changes. As wages are flat for millions of working people in this country, the rich are getting a lot richer. And as the federal government and state governments across the country pass tax cuts and slash budgets, the ultra-wealthy are stepping in to fund everything from the charter school movement to climate change groups like the Sierra Club. In his new book, The Givers, Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age, David Callahan writes, quote, "The philanthropic elite now emerging is not just more influential than most people realize. It's more extensive, commanding a growing array of institutions that reach into nearly every corner of American society. The key point," he writes, "is not which team of philanthropists are winning or losing on this or that issue. Rather, it's how these givers are becoming more powerful while ordinary Americans struggle to get their voices heard at all." End quote. David Callahan is the author of 7 books and founder and editor of the media website Inside Philanthropy. And he joins us from the studios of NPR West. Hi, David. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for writing this book, such an important topic. I want to start off by talking about wealth, because as you write, a lot of people don't realize just how philanthropy has changed over the years. And I'm willing to bet that a lot of people don't realize just how wealthy people are. And you write that thanks to a recent boom time and historically low tax rates, the wealthy now have more spare cash than ever before to put behind their economic views. You write, for example, that Warren Buffett, we hear about him a lot, he added $25 billion to his fortune between 2005 and 2015. Bill Gates added even more. His net worth is nearly $80 billion. Who else would you add to that mega rich list?
Well, Mark Zuckerberg now is worth $62 billion.
Wow.
And the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, back in 2005, they were worth $9 billion together. Today, they're worth over $90 billion. George Soros in 2005 was worth $7 billion. Now he's worth $26 billion. So the rich really do keep getting richer and richer, and many of those people I just mentioned are engaged in large-scale philanthropy.
Larry Ellison added $40 billion to his wealth between 2005 and 2015. Jeff Bezos of Amazon, who also now owns the Washington Post, added $42 billion. Phil Knight of Nike gained $17 billion in wealth during the decade. What about people we might not hear about on a regular basis?
Yeah, well, if you just keep going down that list in the Forbes 400, there's a remarkable number of billionaires that nobody's ever heard of who are worth $10 or $15 billion. And here's a statistic that really kind of blew my mind, which is in 1982, when that Forbes 400 list first came out, it had only 13 billionaires on it. And you only needed $80 million to get onto the Forbes 400. The richest person on the list had $2 billion. Now, the 2017 list came out recently. You can't get on the list unless you have $1.7 billion.
Wow.
And Gates, Bill Gates, who now has $87 billion, is the wealthiest person on the list. And together, those 400 households, they have a combined net worth of $2.5 trillion, which is more than the bottom half of American households put together.
And a recent report came out looking at fast food CEOs. The Starbucks CEO, for example, they make about $9,000 per hour.
Yes, it's really startling, although I should say it's the CEOs aren't the people who build up the biggest fortunes. It tends to be the people who are on Wall Street or in tech or who are accumulating their money through stocks. The list of the highest earning hedge fund managers just came out this week. The top person on the list, Jim Simons, made $1.6 billion in 2016.
Wow.
Simons, by the way, is a very active philanthropist, and probably all that money he made is going to go to philanthropy.
Tell us more about him. I've never heard of him.
Jim Simons, fascinating guy. He was a math whiz, got his PhD in mathematics. for a time was chair of the math department of SUNY Stony Brook in New York. Then he left and started a hedge fund in the early 1980s to kind of put his math chops to work, try to gaming markets and outsmarting markets. And the Renaissance Technologies, his hedge fund, became the most successful hedge fund of all time. He's now worth about $19 billion, and he and his wife, Marilyn, have created one of the top science foundations in the United States, backing basic science. Simons, by the way, is also a major donor to the Democratic Party.
You looked at what you call the ever more sophisticated ways wealth is being used to shape our society. For this book, what questions were you seeking to answer specifically? What were some of the big questions?
Well, first, I wanted to know who these people are and how they think, what their rationales are for giving, and what they want in terms of changes to society, and how they operate, how they're trying to pull the levers of power using their wealth through philanthropy. You know, there's a lot that one could talk about when it comes to philanthropy in terms of how effective people are at solving different problems. My interest was really specifically about the influence these folks have in public policy and looking at the ways in which that wealth can be converted into power in terms of shaping what government does, whether it's on an issue like climate change or criminal justice or healthcare. Just a whole range of issues where philanthropists are now trying to have an impact.
You've been writing about philanthropy for many years. What major changes have you seen?
The biggest change is that when I first started writing about philanthropy in the 1990s, the terrain was very much dominated by these big legacy foundations that had been created many years before, whose donors were long gone. Think of the Ford Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation. Now, the terrain of philanthropy is very much dominated by these living donors, people like Jim Simons or Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, who have really want to put their wealth to work now in trying to solve problems or making changes in society. They don't want to leave it, just pile up and have it sit in a foundation that exists in perpetuity, like the Rockefeller Foundation. Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan are a great example of that. They have devoted themselves to giving away all of their wealth during their lifetime. And of course, they're quite young, so they have a long runway there. But many donors think the same way. They want to hit the ground running now.
What are the major differences between, say, Republican donors, Democratic donors, and Libertarian donors? What really stood out for you when you saw differences of how people spend their money?
Just to be clear, I think that they all share in common a desire to make the world a better place. They may disagree quite strongly in terms of what that means, but most of them really have the best of intentions. You know, the Koch brothers, for example, are often criticized for looking out for their own bottom line, and it's really just about advancing Koch Industries. But Charles Koch was a libertarian well before he was a billionaire back in the 1960s. He held these same beliefs. I look at donors to the American Enterprise Institute, which is one of the top conservative think tanks in Washington. Many of those people, they were quite conservative before they became wealthy. So what happens is people, as soon as they get some serious money, look for ways to spread their views. And many of them actually embrace the same strategies for doing that. Think tanks are a powerful way that you can put forth your ideas. The American Enterprise Institute is extremely influential. It raised over $50 million in a recent year from conservative donors. And there's more donors on the left who are embracing think tanks as well. I write about a philanthropist named Herb Sandler who created, with his wife Marion, bankrolled the creation of the Center for American Progress, which is the top liberal think tank in Washington right now. So you know, these people understand how power works, and they understand that ideas are very influential, and that if you can put money behind policy ideas and developing these, the kind of rationale for changes in public policy and pushing them up out into the broader debate and into Congress, that you can really have a big impact.
You write that these donors might agree with the rest of us about social issues, but when it comes to economic issues, that's where you see a sharp change. For example, one survey funded by the Russell Sage Foundation found that the general public was much more likely than the wealthy to favor a higher minimum wage, expanded tax credits for low-income workers, job creation efforts by the government. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
The rich really are different from the rest of us. And this is an important point, because it'd be one thing if these philanthropists with so much influence and power were kind of a mirror of American society at large. And people often try to make that argument that philanthropy by the wealthy, it's fine because they back all sorts of different ideas and in the public square, and we have this sort of robust pluralism. But that's not true, because the wealthy do tend to be more conservative on those economic issues. And that survey you just mentioned is just one survey which shows that the wealthy are pretty far to the right of ordinary Americans. Globalization and trade is a great example that there are very little philanthropic contributions have gone to kind of look at the dangers of global trade to American workers, or examine some of the problems with these free trade agreements. And lo and behold, Donald Trump comes along and really embraces that issue and kind of weaponizes it. But it just was something that philanthropists neglected, because almost all wealthy people from the business world think free trade is a great thing. So there is no questioning of that idea.
No questioning, even at some of these Democratic-leaning think tanks.
Right. And here's the thing, which is that if you look at who in Washington is getting money from philanthropists to do work on economic issues, the think tanks on the right get much more money than the think tanks on the left for work on issues like taxes, regulation, oversight of Wall Street. Trying to dismantle oversight of Wall Street is high on their agenda. And think tanks on the left, a place like the Economic Policy Institute, which is a progressive think tank challenging the nature of capitalism we have now and inequality, its budget is $5 million a year in a recent year. I noticed the Heritage Foundation, which is the top right-wing organization, has a budget of $90 million a year. So there's a big imbalance there. However, you know, maybe the good news if you're a progressive is that a lot of new money has flowed into work on climate change and for LGBT rights. And I describe that giving in my book in some detail.
To that point, we have an email from a listener who says, this might sound ridiculous, but are any of these folks politically left of, say, the Democratic Party?
I wouldn't say that they're left of the Democratic Party. However, you know, the Democratic Party has moved left in the last 10 or 15 years. And one reason it's been pulled left is because there have been more liberal donors who have shown up on the scene and who believe that the Democratic Party needs to stand more strongly for progressive principles. And in 2005, a bunch of them got together and created something called the Democracy Alliance, which is a network of high net worth individuals that has been funding a progressive policy infrastructure and trying to do what the conservatives did so well, which is building this kind of world of think tanks and advocacy groups and litigation organizations and media watchdogs and leadership training institutes. The right spent billions of dollars creating that kind of infrastructure to push their conservative vision, and the left has been trying to sort of play catch up in the last decade, and they've been doing that because there's new money that's come onto the scene from some progressive donors.
Today, we're speaking with David Callahan about his new book, The Givers, Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. David is founder and editor of the media site Inside Philanthropy. He started writing about this issue back in the 90s, and he's seen major changes. As wages are flat for millions of working people in this country, the rich are getting a lot richer. And he also points out that as the government and governments across the country really pass tax cuts and slash budgets, the ultra wealthy are stepping in to fund everything from the charter school movement to climate change. If you have any questions or comments for David about philanthropy, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you think about this major role that philanthropists are now playing in our society? There's not much accountability. What does that say? And then what does it say about democracy? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have another email from a listener who says, no one really talks about this topic, so thank you for the show. I've heard that this creates a lot of isolation, so to speak. Every NGO or nonprofit is vying for a continuation of funding, so they're in a kind of a competition in certain ways when their work overlaps. There's not as much collaboration and solidarity as there might be if everyday community members were supporting them with time and financial contributions. What are your thoughts on that, David?
We have seen a shift in the past 30 or 40 years from having nonprofits that are supported by lots and lots of members to having nonprofits that are supported by fewer and fewer people writing bigger and bigger checks, right? So if you kind of roll back the clock to, say, 1960 and look at civil society and the nonprofit sector, it was dominated by large membership organizations. Unions were obviously one example of that, but others, veterans organizations, mothers organizations, the League of Women Voters, different kinds of civic clubs and networks. These were some of the top players in our civil society. Then, starting in the 1970s, we see that the rise of this whole network of advocacy nonprofits and think tanks in Washington, that this new age of kind of checkbook activism and donor-driven nonprofit work. And it is a problem because and I think it's hurt the left in part because you don't really need to mobilize ordinary citizens the same way if you get your funding from a handful of wealthy donors or foundations.
You also write the key point isn't who is winning left or right, but that ordinary Americans are struggling to get their voices heard.
Right, exactly. And this rise of philanthropy is coming at a time when many citizens already feel disenfranchised and feel the wealthy have too much power. A simple way to think about this is that rising economic inequality, which we've seen over the past few decades, has translated into greater political and civic inequality. Mm-hmm. And, we're familiar with how that's happened in our politics. We all know that these big donors and super PACs have kind of displaced political parties as some of the top power brokers in politics in terms of who wins primaries, who gets elected. But we haven't heard so much about how all this new wealth is creating inequality in civil society and in our civic life. And philanthropy is a big part of that story. And I think people tend to not want to be critical of philanthropists because it's true that they're doing many positive things. And I just want to make sure that my remarks here don't overshadow all the good things that philanthropists are doing. Many of them are trying to solve all kinds of problems. And I write about that in my book. Mike Bloomberg is a great example of a philanthropist who has had a really positive impact. He gave a huge amount of money to the Sierra Club to shut down coal-fired power plants and has been quite successful, that effort to shut down coal plants around the country, which of course contribute to climate change but also cause pollution. Now, I happen to think Bloomberg is great. If I was a coal miner in West Virginia, I might have a different view of that.
You also write that Michael Bloomberg gave $53 million to fight overfishing and reform fishing practices. This is something that I hadn't heard of. And you write, while billions of people, or actually Michael Bloomberg said this when he made a gift, while billions of people depend on fish for food or income, only 13% of the world's fisheries are safe from being overfished, presenting serious environmental and public health challenges. Data shows the world's severely threatened fish populations can rebound if fishing is properly managed. So he spent $53 million on this issue.
Yes. And it's nothing compared to how much money he spent to try to reduce tobacco-related deaths in poorer countries. He's given over $600 million to trying to reduce the smoking deaths, which now about 6 million people die a year worldwide. And it's a great example of philanthropists with big ambitions and a drive to try to make the world a better place. Bloomberg, by the way, has also given hundreds of millions of dollars to try to reduce traffic deaths in developing countries. So he's been a very effective philanthropist.
You write that Bloomberg was worth just under $5 billion as he took office as mayor of New York in 2002. By the time he left, that figure soared to $33 billion. And then it climbed even higher to $40 billion. That's one of the points you make, is that once you become an ultra-billionaire, you just become richer and richer.
Yeah. Bloomberg now, by the way, is worth $48 billion.
Wow.
So it is astonishing. You know, when Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan pledged to give away all of their Facebook wealth in 2015, they were worth about $40 billion. Now that stock is worth $62 billion, as I mentioned. And so these are big numbers. And these philanthropists are coming onto the scene with deeper pockets at the same time that government is really struggling with cuts to discretionary spending for science and education and parks and environmental protection. Those cuts were underway well before Donald Trump was elected president.
As a result of massive tax cuts, that's a question I wanted to ask you before we go to break. If you have someone like Bloomberg spending $50 million to fight overfishing, to deal with health effects of smoking, to try to reduce traffic accidents, does this send a message to government, keep cutting taxes because the wealthy will just step in and deal with these social problems?
Well, I think that the cuts to government spending have been driven more by a combination of libertarian ideology. Obviously the right has been trying to downsize government for decades. And it's also increasingly driven by pressures, demographic pressures, as more of these baby boomers retire and entitlement costs go up. And I think those pressures are going to keep playing out over the long run and squeezing that discretionary spending, which covers everything from science to education and the environment and so many other things. We see those pressures, by the way, also playing out at the state and local level, where pension obligations are coming due. So these, local governments have less money, and philanthropists are also stepping forward in different cities to do things that government used to do.
David Callahan is author of the new book, The Givers: Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. He writes that as wages are flat for millions of working people, the rich are getting a lot richer. The philanthropic elite now emerging is not just more influential than most people realize. It's more extensive, commanding a growing array of institutions that reach into nearly every corner of American society. So what do you think? What questions and comments do you have about what David calls elite philanthropy? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you may go to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-TALK. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Thanks to all the listeners who've supported KLW's May campaign. When the pitching ended on Saturday at noon, we were at $55,000 short of our goal of $400,000. Now, thanks to the support that continues to come, we are just $34,000 away. Reaching the goal is important for KLW to continue to grow and stay on track financially. If you'd like to help us close the gap, please give us your support today at klw.org, and thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about how big oil is influencing California politicians. Speaking of money and politics, in the last 6 years, big oil has spent more than $122 million on campaign contributions and lobbying to increase production. On Saturday, activists will be marching in Sacramento to tell California Governor Jerry Brown and politicians to stop taking money from the oil industry. We'll talk about that tomorrow. And then on Friday, we are going to be following what is happening with the latest scandal coming out of Washington, D.C. We are now hearing politicians saying the word impeachment. So we're going to follow that over the next few days and then talk about how the media are covering this. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by David Callahan. He's the author of 7 books. His latest is The Givers, Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. He's founder and editor of the media site Inside Philanthropy. He's been covering philanthropy since the 90s, and he's seen a lot of changes. The rich are getting a lot richer, and as the government cuts taxes, slashes budgets, the wealthy are stepping in to fund everything from the charter school movement to climate change efforts. So if you have any questions or comments for David, what do you think about this, the wealthy stepping in to tackle some of these social issues? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you work for a nonprofit or a foundation, what changes have you seen over the past few decades? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Bonnie in Palo Alto. Hi, Bonnie. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. David, I want to know, because I have been involved with nonprofits for a while, did you happen to mention that the original sort of founding idea of the nonprofits was a tax write-off for the very wealthy, and it was a way that they could sort of stash their money without having to pay inheritance taxes? And they're only mandated since 1969 to give away 5% of their corpus.
Thanks, Bonnie. David?
Well, thank you, Bonnie, for raising the issue of the tax deduction, which was created a century ago by Congress to incentivize charitable giving. And as Bonnie mentioned, there was some more changes to that law in 1969. She was referring to the fact that if you have a private foundation, you only have to pay out 5% of the endowment of that foundation. And the logic there is to allow foundations to exist in perpetuity. Many donors create foundations that are intended to address issues for literally centuries to come. The Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, the Ford Foundation, these are all foundations that are designed to last in perpetuity. And there is growing controversy about this, because more and more money is piling up in these foundations, and it's piling up at a time when government programs of all kinds are being cut, and that charitable tax deduction, which is helping fuel even bigger piles of money stashed in foundations, is, I think, going to come under more scrutiny, because it costs the Treasury about $50 billion a year.
Wow.
At a time when we're yanking Section 8 vouchers away from poor families, cutting people off of food stamps, cutting Pell Grants for students, all sorts of things. And we have to take a look at that money lost to the charitable tax deduction and ask, are we really getting the best deal from that? And the consensus generally has been yes, that deduction is well worth it. But I don't think the charitable sector has done such a great job of defending the importance of that deduction.
You write that when Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan pledged to use 99% of their shares in Facebook to, quote, make the world a better place, a lot of people criticized this. The Atlantic called it the non-charity charity and said that this $45 billion amounted to tax avoidance and an undemocratic power grab.
There are a lot of concerns about that. And you know, here's the thing. The notion that Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg were looking to dodge taxes is silly, because these are people who really do want to give away all their money. They have far more than they could ever use in their lifetime, and they're not out to get a tax break. That said, the way that they proceeded did raise some concerns, because they, instead of creating a traditional foundation, they created an LLC, which is less transparent, and it's harder to know what they're up to. And that is a lot of power in the hands of private individuals. And they have, for example, hired the former campaign manager of Barack Obama to be their kind of political point person. And that's, you know, that's a formidable amount of influence that they're able to wield through their Chan Zuckerberg initiative. Fortunately, these are people with really great intentions, and you know, if you want anybody to be giving away that kind of money, it's certainly somebody like Priscilla Chan, who grew up in an immigrant household and has been a frontline practitioner trying to solve social problems her entire adult life.
Although you do write about Mark Zuckerberg giving money to the state of New Jersey and working with then Mayor Cory Booker and Newark Mayor and then Governor Chris Christie. We did a show about this and how they wanted to, quote, reform education in New Jersey without talking to community members. And they got a lot of backlash for that. And we have an email from Paul on this issue. And he writes, I'm in support of accountability for nonprofits, but it seems the obsession on the part of big philanthropy with data-driven social welfare interventions have vice-locked the nonprofit service providers. Organizations must craft interventions that not only match the philanthropist's agenda, but will make the grant makers look good in terms of numbers. Where is the voice of the communities who are served by these dollars? Where is the sustainability?
Well, a couple of issues there. So the gift to the Newark public school system by Mark Zuckerberg came in 2010, and that effort to reform schools in Newark did generate a lot of pushback from the local community that felt that they hadn't been engaged enough, and that there's just this top-down effort backed by faraway billionaires. However, it's worth noting that after that, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan gave an even bigger gift to improve schools in Silicon Valley, and they proceeded quite differently. They did a lot more listening and really engaged all the local stakeholders. In other words, they walked away from that Newark experience apparently having learned some hard lessons about the need to engage people. And so these philanthropists do learn from their missteps and do evolve. And in terms of the broader question of being responsive to nonprofits, that's a good one. And I think that there is a recognition among the smart philanthropists that they really need to do a lot of listening and to engage stakeholders. Otherwise, they're not going to be successful in their ends. If the nonprofits that are on the front lines and the donors are not on the same page, it can create a lot of disruption and few really effective results.
David Callahan is author of The Givers, Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What are your thoughts about all of this elite philanthropy, as David calls it? The rich are getting a lot richer, and they are stepping in as we are seeing massive budget cuts by governments to fund everything from the climate change movement to the charter school movement. Almost any social issue you can name, wealthy people are spending money either giving directly to organizations or creating foundations. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I think maybe we need to change the terms of this, because I think when we use words like givers and philanthropists, we kind of hide what's really going on, which is that these people are making these enormous amount of money only because they're able to benefit from rigging the system and getting the profits, and these enormous profits from either slave labor or wage theft or land theft, or creating a system that benefits them exclusively. So when we turn around and say, oh, these people who have now, you know, had, like Apple, huge plants in China where people are paid almost nothing and then are making profits off that, and then they're turning around and giving money to things that they think, you know, may be laudable, that somehow that's gotten this neutral term of philanthropy. I think we need to really look at how we use language to hide where this money is coming from, and how this money is nothing more than robber barons profiting off of the labor of other people and the land, whether it be fossil fuels, who are raping the environment, which is ours. So I think we need to look at them as what they are, thieves.
Well, thank you, Lisa. In the book, David writes that Facebook and Google, for example, have both engaged in elaborate tax avoidance schemes using offshore subsidiaries, and Apple, which is being celebrated for its big turn toward philanthropy under CEO Tim Cook, is an even worse offender, pioneering new forms of tax avoidance. One analysis found that Apple's tax avoidance schemes allowed it to avoid $2.4 billion in taxes in 2011 alone. So what about that, David? What about Lisa's points?
Well, I don't agree with Lisa that all wealth creation is somehow a product of theft and exploitation. One reason why the wealthy are getting so rich is because we have much larger global markets, and we have technology which allows people to make much more money with technological products than in the past. Take something like eBay, which was created by Pierre Omidyar, a product that never existed, created this online marketplace. And Omidyar walked away as a billionaire and became a top philanthropist. I don't think that he engaged in some kind of wage theft or exploitation to create that site. He had a great idea. He found a market that didn't exist. That said, I do think that the system has been rigged in favor of the wealthy in some key respects, namely that taxes have been historically low since the early 1980s with Ronald Reagan, and taxes in particular on capital gains have been low. That's the way many wealthy people make their money, and capital gains are taxed at a lower rate than regular income, and it's allowed these people to pile up huge amounts of wealth, particularly on Wall Street, where many of those winnings by hedge fund managers are taxed at a low rate, which has attracted a lot of controversy, but as yet no reform.
I think Lisa was referring to people like Phil Knight, who gained $17 billion in wealth during the year 2005 and 2015. I mean, we all know that Nike is infamous for its sweatshops overseas. And then Jeff Bezos with Amazon. There have been lots of stories about Amazon workers in warehouses who struggle to get by. The Walton Foundation, for example, with Walmart, same kind of thing. I think she was talking specifically, not everyone that you're talking about, but you can definitely look at some of these people and then trace their wealth back to very low wages, for example, either here or overseas.
Yeah, and I think that the Walton family's wealth is a great example of that. Walmart has been predicated on a low wage model, and that family is now the wealthiest family in the world. That said, if you had a Walmart store network that paid higher wages, if you had fewer abuses in the global supply chain, if you had Amazon's warehouse workers paid more, these people would still be phenomenally wealthy. They'd be a little less wealthy, which would be a good thing in my view, but they'd still be phenomenally wealthy because of the size of global markets and the productivity gains from technological change allows people to just assemble much greater fortunes now than in earlier times.
David, you interview a lot of these wealthy philanthropists, whatever you want to call them. Do you ever ask them, why don't you just pay people a better wage so they don't need some of these extra services?
Well, the I was interested in some different questions, less interested in how they made their money and more interested in the kind of the democratic implications of giving it away. So Eli Broad, for example, I put the question to him. You know, he's been very influential in trying to change public schools. And I say, oh, who are you to be having so much influence over the public school system, which people view as a very democratic institution in American life? And his answer actually was interesting, which he said that, well, the teachers' unions have been the biggest donors in influencing public school systems, and we wealthy donors are just trying to level the playing field. And that's how many of them see themselves.
Well, thank you for calling in. If you have any questions about education, since David just brought that up, we'd love to hear from you. We're getting a few emails about education. But a few callers have been on the line for a while, so let's go to Thomas in Mill Valley. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Mr. Callahan, I'm concerned, not concerned, but I thought it was interesting. Basically, what you're saying is we are now in a situation where we have dueling billionaires.
Thomas, what do you mean by that?
Dueling billionaires. We have, for example, the Koch brothers, and they put all their money into mostly into local elections and state elections so they can influence the state outcomes. Then you have people like the Zuckerbergs and the Chans and so forth, and even Soros, who put their monies. But basically what we're ending up is dueling billionaires who are putting their monies into their particular agenda, which goes back to when we had a situation in the post-World War II era where taxation was like 70 to 90% of the wealthy people. Somebody else made the decision about where that charitable money went.
Right. Yeah. What about that, David?
Well, I do have that image in my book of these dueling billionaires, that public policy debates today can look like these Greek gods throwing lightning bolts at each other. And I cite the example of the Iran nuclear debate, which people will remember from 2015 when the Obama administration was bringing its deal over the Iran nuclear program to Washington and to Congress. And there was just an outpouring of all this debate and advertising and PR blitzes from both sides. And if you looked at where that money was coming from, it was almost all coming from very wealthy individuals or foundations, while sort of ordinary people, ordinary citizens, weren't really weighing in on that debate much at all. And more of our politics and public policy debates feel like that, that the citizens don't have much of a voice, that it is so kind of choreographed by these super donors.
Thank you for calling in, Thomas. Let's go next to Pam in San Mateo. Hi, Pam. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A quick point. Nobody seems to be talking about the point that maybe one of the reasons why big donors, as well as those of us who are small donors, don't agree with the government priorities necessarily as to where our money should go. My father-in-law used to tell us that if you don't like where the government is spending your money, then it's up to you to support your own favorite charities so that you have some say in actually where your money would go. I personally would rather not be spending a lot of my money on the military-industrial complex, so I try to lower my tax bill so that I have the feeling that the money that I actually am giving is doing some good. Don't you think that maybe a lot of the entrepreneurs that you cite feel the same way, that they would rather actually establish their own priorities for their giving?
Well, absolutely, and it explains why a lot of people create foundations when they die rather than leave their money to estate taxes, because they feel their wealth would be better used by private foundations. And there is that does set aside America, by the way. In Western Europe, for example, there's much more of a belief in government and democratic means of distributing the wealth created by society. And here we've always placed a greater faith in civil society as a place where a lot of problems are solved. And many philanthropists do specifically with their giving focus in on problems that they think the government hasn't solved or can't solve and to provide public goods, in effect, that the government is not providing.
Can you talk? We don't have much time left, but I'd like you to talk about Pete Peterson. He is a financier, very wealthy, and he spent a lot of time trying to get the government in the 90s and during the Obama administration to talk about the deficit. I mean, remember that during Obama we heard about nonstop deficit, deficit, deficit. And Pete Peterson and the Peterson Foundation was really behind that. Tell us a little bit about him.
Pete Peterson is an interesting figure. He was a commerce secretary under Richard Nixon, very influential kind of establishment figure. He became a private equity billionaire. And when he kind of sold his stake in the private equity business, he turned to philanthropy and committed to give away most of his wealth. And he has embraced as his main cause tackling America's long-term fiscal challenges, which he sees as being driven by unsustainable spending on entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security. And during that first term of the Obama administration, when the economy was still struggling to get out of the recession, he gave a lot of money through his foundation to push this idea that addressing deficits should be the top priority of Washington. And it's a great example of how the wealthy think differently from ordinary people, because polls showed at the time that most ordinary Americans wanted government to focus on creating jobs and helping get people back to work. And, of course, cutting deficits can have a negative effect on the economy because it can throw people out of work when they lose their jobs working for government. And so Pete Peterson, he wanted to challenge long-term entitlement spending and not make immediate cuts, but the effect was to help kind of legitimize this push toward cutting government now, especially after the Tea Party came to power in that 2010 election. And we did get major cuts in government budgets that were passed in 2011 as part of that deficit reduction drive, which have reverberated for years since in terms of less money for scientific funding, less money for parks, less money for space exploration, you name it. We're still feeling the effects of those cuts that the Peterson Foundation helped kind of usher in.
I remember when all of this went down, and at the time I was even thinking, what is it with Pete Peterson and ultra-wealthy people who are obsessed with talking about Medicare and Social Security? Have you ever asked them why they focus so much on those issues and why they want them to be cut?
Well, the United States actually does face some serious fiscal challenges, and I point those out in my book, that as the boomers retire, unless we control health care costs, those Medicare and Medicaid expenditures are going to gobble up more and more of the budget. I happen to think that the way to deal with that is focusing on reducing the role of markets in our healthcare system. But these challenges are real. And interestingly, one of Pete Peterson's new ventures is to try to focus in on healthcare costs and reduce healthcare costs. And he's given over $200 million to a center to try to do exactly that, which I think it makes a lot of sense.
But with Social Security, as Bernie Sanders continues to talk about, you lift the cap and you're fine. I think it's over, what, $275,000 people who make that. I just want to understand, why are they always talking about Social Security and Medicare, which are two very popular programs? And especially as people struggle to make ends meet, people need those programs.
Right. And I think that Social Security particularly is going to have to be expanded in coming years and that the that Social Security doesn't really have very serious problems. Medicare is the bigger challenge, and that relates to out-of-control health care costs because we have too much power in the hands of big pharmaceutical companies and too much power in the hands of hospitals and doctors. And until we rein in that influence of those private actors in our healthcare system, the challenges and the threats to Medicare are very real.
We have an email from Rob who says, the wealthy have no constituency. They could do good things or not, but these are actually massive social resources without any input. Wealth needs to be better taxed. It's kind of obvious, and it's done better in Europe. And we've done a lot of shows about that. David, where do you think this is going? You say that the ultra wealthy are going to spend even more money on these issues in the years to come.
I do think that we're going to continue to see a power shift away from government and to wealthy philanthropists. And that has a lot to do with just these long-term trends in government spending, that government is increasingly going to struggle just to meet its existing obligations. Even if we do substantially raise taxes on the wealthy and find a way to control those health care costs, there's going to be less spare money available by the public sector to solve problems because of how expensive it is to help the boomers retire. And so I do think that that power shift is going to keep happening. And among other things, it really suggests to me that we need to get a handle on this underlying problem of wealth inequality. And I do think we need to raise taxes on the wealthy, and particularly raise taxes on capital gains, which is how the wealthiest of the wealthy make most of their money.
And just quickly, what about the voice of the people? What happens in the coming years as wealthy people spend more money? What happens to the voice of average people?
I think that there's a possibility of kind of more sense of disenfranchisement and alienation, and that this populist wave that we've been seeing with the Tea Party, with Black Lives Matter, now with Indivisible, the kind of pushback to Donald Trump and his billionaire administration, I think that that populist wave is going to gain strength in the United States if we don't get a handle on these wealth inequality issues. And at some point, I think that populist anger may be directed at philanthropy, which is increasingly seen as a tool by which the wealthy exercise undue influence in U.S. society.
David Callahan is founder of the media site Inside Philanthropy. His newest book is called The Givers: Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age. David, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.